Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Was there, I wonder, any place in the old empire where frauds and charlatans could lead such splendid lives as Australia? Crime and power went hand in hand. Ruin was never forever. Reputations could always be remade. In Sydney in the last decades of the 19th and early decades of the 20th century, Richard Marr was such a man. A marvellous biography of him has just appeared, and later I'm talking to its author Patrick Mullins about Marr, his world, and biography. But first we indunt in Britain to reflect on, among other things, our King's triumph in Washington. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
They do seem to take kings terribly seriously in the USA, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And he knew how to play it as well. I mean, it's a pretty pitch-perfect speech where you're just trying to be as politically pointed as possible while not overstepping the line and saying it explicitly. So it's an exercise in just how obvious can you make your subtlety, basically. And I mean, the royal family is very good at that sort of thing. I mean, that's sort of how they've governed for a long time. And it worked. I mean, look, he made the points that you'd want him to make, you know, for Ukraine, for NATO, for multiculturalism, for the environment. It helps that he does actually genuinely believe this stuff. I mean, you know, we know enough because he had his whole lifetime with a bit more freedom to speak freely as the prince than he did as the king. We actually have a pretty good idea of what his political opinions are. And in some areas, they're reactionary, like in architecture and town planning, they're pretty reactionary. But, you know, in other areas, they were ahead of their time, for instance, on climate change and the environment. So, you know, he did a good job up there. I have to say, you know, and so there's a lot of backpatting now. I mean, he'll feel that it went well. The Labour government would have felt, you know, good, just as well. We went ahead with it. And, you know, we've got this kind of high value intermediary we can use to, you know, improve the relationship. I just think none of it makes the slightest bit of difference.
Oh, Ian, and even before we get to your depressing conclusion, I have a couple of questions to ask. When Charles opens his mouth in Congress, who's speaking? Is it him or his British government?
Very good. No, it is him, because the British government serves, ostensibly, I mean constitutionally, serves him. So constitutionally, it's him talking, because there is no higher anything apart from God. However, in the reality of it, as you'll know, you know, when the king sits down to do the king's speech, as he will do very shortly in a couple of weeks, in the British Parliament to unveil what the laws are, even though it is the king speaking, it is, of course, really the government just writing a speech and he has to read out whatever it is that they say.
Word for word.
Yeah, exactly. But in this context, and in fact, in terms of the literal who is writing this speech, he would have had a part in that speech, and the speechwriters would have been in the palace. And of course, all of that is negotiated with number 10 and with the Foreign Office, but he would have had a hand in writing that speech.
And every paragraph is a reproach to Trump. The president is currently praying loud and clear for victory over Iran, but not Charles.
Having devoted a large part of my life to interfaith relationships and greater understanding, it is that faith in the triumph of light over darkness, which I have found confirmed countless times.
And now, how could Trump sort of stand up and argue against that? But what about the good word that Charles put in for the rule of law, which is just every day of the week, trashed by Trump?
The rule of law, the certainty of stable and accessible rules, an independent judiciary resolving disputes and delivering impartial justice. These features created the conditions for centuries of unmatched economic growth in our two countries.
And the applause again and again was wild. But, Ian, the realist from Westminster, you reckon this is not going to make really any difference with Trump?
Yeah, I just don't see that any of this has any effect whatsoever. And then he's clearly, you know, if you look at that applause, it often starts on the Democrat side And then, you know, others feel they have to get involved. I mean, because, of course, everything that what Charles is saying here now, it feels like really pointed political commentary. At any other time, you know, in our lifetime, that would have just been considered incredibly banal political truisms.
Exactly.
You know, about the rule of,
exactly. Which, you know, is why it's so hard for Trump to argue against them, because it's just kind of almost nursery time political truisms.
Yeah, exactly. So then you sort of think, okay, so maybe he's aiming for the Democrats. But you think, like, really? I mean, are we on? I think they see him as this kind of like pleasant, exotic bauble, but not something. I mean, it's not like he's going to suddenly stimulate a sense of resistance they have been unable to discover in their own terms. So what does happen with the speech? I mean, everyone feels better about it, and they feel that you've, you know, to some extent spoken truth in there. But really, what does Trump want from it? It's that he likes the shiny, glowy things. You know, he likes golden decorations and Nobel Prizes and imaginary trophies invented by sporting bodies. That's what he wants. And that's really what the royal family is to him. It's just like the ultimate shiny, glowy thing. And he gets the glow off the visit. And by continuing with this visit, this is what breaks my mind. I feel us forgetting it already. Like, he threatened a genocide. And that really wasn't very long ago. That was just a few weeks ago, and he threatened a genocide. And we can either say to ourselves, well, things will just continue as normal and we just bank it in the Trump's a nutter thing. Or we can say that is like we are living in a different world to the one we were living in before a US president threatened the genocide. And if that's true, and I really hope that is true, we shouldn't be allowing a royal family to go over there and to make that regime look more valid, to launder its reputation by virtue of those photos. And those photos and the imagery, the idea that, well, the most we'll do if you threaten a genocide is some coded, subtle criticism of you, that ultimately serves his purposes more than his purposes retreat by virtue of the commentary that Charles offered in that speech to Congress.
Yes, and since then he has posted on his own website a picture of himself with an automatic gun standing in front of a blazing landscape, telling the Iranians it's time they came to their senses. And he's called it No More Mr. Nice Guy. Ian, talking about nice guys, Starmer in London, you have a wonderful piece of analysis in the iPaper this week about the damage Starmer does as he changes his mind. Explain.
This always does them in the end. It's something that people don't sort of notice too much from outside of the government building. But it's that each morning, a prime minister sends out members of cabinet in order to defend their position, defend the position of the cabinet, defend the position of the prime minister.
On radio, usually it's like, on television, on...
Exactly. They do the morning round. And here, that's the Today programme on Radio 4. It's Sky News. It's the BBC News. And it's probably one of the morning shows, typically the one on ITV. And they'll go and defend the government's position. And usually that's of no problem at all. When you always sound like a bit of a robot because you're clearly not speaking from the heart or using any kind of independent judgment. But that's okay, because the audience that you're going for is the audience in number 10 in the government. It's not really the audience at home. But if sometimes when a prime minister's in trouble, they start asking them to say the most preposterous gibberish. Boris Johnson was having to do this over Partygate. You know, it was perfectly within the rules to drink wine with people when everyone was living under those rules at the time and knew that it wasn't. Keir Starmer is now doing it by virtue of the Mandelson US ambassador appointment that he orchestrated and now says was terribly unfair. And so they start to look like fools. And then something terrible happens, which is that the prime minister starts to change their mind and retreat from the position that they held the day before. Now, that bit, that calculated retreat, that's when you burn up the loyalties of the people around you, because you make them look like mugs. They were just out there in the morning, you know, staking their reputation, using up their reputational capital, saying the line that you told them to say. And now you change the line. Now, he changes his mind a lot. He changes his mind on all sorts of policies. He changes his mind on an immigration speech, on welfare reform, on all sorts of matters. And now he's changing his mind on something that directly reflects on his integrity. Like last week, he came out to attack Ollie Robbins, the head of the Foreign Office, for basically helping to approve the Mandelson appointment as US ambassador, which Starmer had himself wanted him to approve. So even that is an example of him massively changing his mind. So then we get these reports from the cabinet table going, the cabinet is just silent. They're staring at their shoes. They're hardly saying anything.
Yes.
Why is it like a funeral? Because they're noting this stuff and saying, why would I go out to bat for someone who's going to change their mind and then burn me as a way of protecting their own career?
It's an episode from Yes Minister.
Yeah, well, it often comes down to that. You know what depresses me the most is that it really is so similar to the Boris Johnson era. I mean, it's not as bad, obviously. Like, this is not, it's not as kind of childlike and infantile. But I mean, it's almost like beat by beat the same. We had Morgan McSweeney yesterday. First time he's really been seen in public.
Who he?
He is the former chief of staff for Keir Starmer, hugely influential, powerful figure behind the scenes, but you never heard from him, you never saw him. Just like Dominic Cummings, who was the same figure for Boris Johnson. Now, Dominic Cummings had to eventually come out over the Barnard Castle incident, in which he claimed, seemingly with all due seriousness, that he would try to test his eyesight by putting his kids and his wife in a car and driving it for several hours.
In now direct contravention of COVID rules.
In direct contravention of the COVID rules and any kind of even rudimentary logic. Now we get Morgan McSweeney forced in front of the camera as well. Again, on not quite as an absurd a proposal as that. But to basically say that, well, we didn't really put any influence to have Peter Mandelson as ambassador, even though they very obviously did everything they could to have Peter Mandelson as ambassador. And it just looks the same. Sloppy, superficial, shallow, Westminster nonsense, when you should be doing the thing that Keir Starmer promised when he was in opposition, which is that it's going to be an adult government of serious people governing in the national interest with a sense of social responsibility to it. Instead, we just got a continuation of what we had before.
But you argue that this kerfuffle, the Mandelson business, is not going to be the end of Starmer.
No, it won't. But I think he survived this week. There was a vote in the Commons yesterday about whether to start an inquiry on whether he'd misled the House. That didn't get anywhere. We're going to have the local elections next Friday. And he's kind of tried to tailor everything in order to prevent there being, basically, to make sure Parliament isn't sitting when the local election results come in, and then to try and reshuffle the government. All of these key sort of things you do just to buy yourself some space. So he's buying himself a bit of space there. But the real thing is, like we said the last time we spoke, the real reason he's not in any immediate danger is because no one wants the job. Like they're watching that straight thing. They just think that's just pain. The Strait of Hormuz, it's incredible. We don't really talk about it. It's just pain. Even if it ends now, it's pain, terrible pain. And if it doesn't end now, and at the moment there's very little reason to think it would, it becomes really quite agonizing pain. You listen to people in the energy market, they are not as sanguine as people in the stock market or people in politics. So if you're a potential Labour leader, why would you want to take over just before the pain? You know, you really want to take over when you're on the other side of that, closer to a general election. If you do it now, you would imagine pretty quickly people will start talking to you about you in similar terms to the way they do to Starmer. And that, the absence of demand for the position rather than supply, that is really the thing that's keeping him alive.
The other thing that you're very interested in at the moment is the sense that a fundamental shift has happened in Britain. And that shift is to march back, no, not march, that would be the wrong word, but to sidle back up to Europe.
Yeah, it's a very well selected word. It's a nervous kind of energy at the moment, but it's really interesting. In the last few weeks, that taboo is being broken with regularity. And we're getting poll after poll that's showing people would like to go back to Europe. It's not clean cut, but basically everyone that voted Remain wants to go back. And about half the people that voted Leave now think it was a bad idea. That's where you're at. And then also there's demographic churn, which is basically Leave voters were older. They've sort of been shuffling off life's mortal coil in the 10 years since the vote. And that changes the electoral dynamics a little bit as well. And then there's the sort of political dynamics, right? Like, who is it that selects the next prime minister if Keir Starmer, as seems likely at some point next couple of years, you know, is thrown out? Well, it's the Labour Party. It's not that there's another election. You choose another Labour leader from within the party, and that process goes out to the membership and it relies on MPs, all people who are very, very, very Remain-y, very, very anti-Brexit. So gradually, the government's movement is this kind of subtle, let's not upset the horses, we'll move as close to Europe as we can, or staying outside of the single market, staying outside of the customs union, staying outside of membership. You can already feel that starting to change. And I think now, if you were a betting man, I say this advisedly, and I want to put a health warning on it, but I think if you were a betting man and you say, what do you think will be in the Labour manifesto for the next election about Europe? Your guess would be it'll probably be a proposal for a referendum on membership.
Ian, thank you for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
My pleasure.
Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, our man in Westminster.